Thanks, Justin. So let me set one thing straight. I am not a regulator. So your point about there being the regulator and the regulated, I'm not a regulator. My co-participants on the putting together the FX code are not a regulator either. So so yes, we went at pains to say this is not regulation because, amongst other things, we aren't regulators. Mm-hmm. It is not regulation. I'm afraid, and you know, I don't think that's really... I think that's fairly clear. So what is it if it's not regulation? Actually, this is what it is. So it's a code for the code of conduct for the global FX market. It's the wholesale market, not the retail market. And what it is 55 principles of what constitutes good practice in the market. It is not about what is bad practice. It's actually about what is good practice in the market. Why did it come about? I think that's pretty self-evident. The FX market didn't cover itself in glory going back a few years. It still keeps the reputational damage that the industry suffered was pretty significant. The fines were also pretty significant. A few billion dollars worth of fines tends to focus the mind. And so there was a clear need to restore the public's faith in the operation of the market. The market participants very much realise that, and I'm a market participant as well. So the central banks, this is a market which we actively participate in every day. So we are coming to this from a point of view of a market participant, as said, not a regulator. So how did we put this thing together? So as Justin said, it was actually a public-private exercise. It had all sides of the market. So it was also global. So this... span, and because in large part because the FX market is global. So we had both central banks and market participants from the top 15 FX centres. So that gets you around about 95-90% or more of the FX market. So a decent chunk. And it had both advanced country FX markets as well as developing emerging market FX centres, including China. But also Brazil, Mexico, Korea, whether you want to regard them as emerging anymore, India involved. And we had all sides of the market involved. So one thing which is slightly different from some of the retail or consumer codes we were talking about earlier. So this is a code for the for the wholesale FX market. We had all parts of the wholesale FX market. So to some extent, we had the customers involved too. In the FX market, what is a customer and what's not is slightly less clear. So we had what this wasn't was a code of conduct for the sell side, for the banks. It's there for the sell side, the buy side, which is sort of asset managers, pension funds and the like, the corporates, particularly the large corporates, and also the non-bank liquidity providers who are neither buy side or sell side. They're somewhere in between, as well as the platforms and all parts of the FX market infrastructure. So the way we did this was there was a group of about 15-odd people from the central banking side and around 30-odd people from the private sector, led by David Puth, who's CEO of CLS, which is sort of basically the core part of the FX market infrastructure. And on David's group, we made sure that it was the representation was spread across all sides of the market, both in terms of where they
now
are,
attending.
What part of the market
Surely
they're in, but also in terms of but also from a geographic perspective as well. As I said, there was coming back to a couple of the points which have been made earlier, there was very much a desire to address the reputational damage that had been done to the FX industry. So amongst other, David Puth has been in the industry for around 40-odd years. I think too much of a disservice in playing how old he is, but quite a long time. Basically, as best as I can tell, has worked with everyone in the FX industry at some time or another and was very much is a respected figure in the industry. And so partly as a result of that, we were able to get the involvement of all of the all parts of the industry. The other, including at a very senior level, so most of the people we had on the group were around about the head of FIC at large global institutions or ran FX for large asset managers. But we also had some people from more on the smaller side of the market, and we had corporates on there as well who played a particularly active role. So the central banks didn't write this code. We wrote it together with the private sector. I mean, literally, in terms of we divvied it up amongst ourselves as to who wrote the first draft of what. One of the other things which was helpful for the exercise was the FCA, the Financial Conduct Authority in the UK. A number of the banks in particular had been through a remediation process with the FCA over the last few years that had to rewrite their own internal codes. And so we were able to basically take a best of what had already been done. Another important point, I think, is that this is principles-based, not rules-based. And one of the reasons for that is once you start writing rules, then you start getting very specific. And then if some particular situation is not exactly covered, then the presumption is, well, that must be okay. Rules are much easier to arbitrage than principles. If it's principles, then you actually have to think about what it is you're doing before you do it. Whereas if it's a rules, then to come back to something you were saying earlier, it's very much a compliance exercise. So the word we use, Justin, is adherence, by the way, not compliance. So you can try that one as a way of describing, you know, we want people to adhere to this thing, not comply with it. But as I said, the idea was we've written a bunch of 55 principles as to what constitutes good behaviour, makes market participants actually have to think about what they're doing. And indeed, you know, FX traders do have a capacity to think, like, surprising to some, but actually they did. So I actually ran this by our FX dealing room, who are very intelligent people. And we actually road tested it on our front office to make sure that they could understand it and knew what we were actually trying to get at. The other thing we did actually was supplement this with examples of what constitutes good behavior. And we did have some examples of what constitutes bad behavior. And one of the problems when you're writing codes of conduct is there's a bunch of stuff which is clearly black and there's a bunch of stuff which is clearly white, but actually there's a very large chunk of stuff which is grey. And again, writing rules-based regulation doesn't really help on the grey. So what we tried to do in terms of principles was widen the part which is black and widen the part which is white as much as possible. And then for the grey, that's where you have to start doing the thinking. Think about what you're doing and whether you can come up with a plausible justification as to why it's consistent with the principle we've expressed in the code. So at least having gone down that process, that gives you some chance of actually probably delivering on good behaviour. The aim here also, so regulation, and I said this isn't regulation, but regulation is often accused of worsening market functioning. What we were trying to do here was actually improve market functioning, because partly as a result of those fines and the consequences which came from them, the functioning of the FX market had actually been deteriorating for a few years. And in particular, one of the things which a bunch of people got fined for was inappropriate sharing of information. So the response to that was, I'm not going to share any information whatsoever. And that was leading into a clear deterioration in market functioning. We were seeing that ourselves firsthand in terms of our operation in the FX market. So I'm just using as an example of how we were trying to improve market functioning. So what we did in the code was say, okay, here's some broad parameters as what constitutes appropriate sharing of information. There's some stuff, to come back to what I was saying earlier, there's some stuff which is clearly bad. Sharing the name of exactly which corporate has given you the order is not something you need to do to complete the trade. Don't share that. However, appropriately aggregated information about what you're seeing in the market gives you some sense about how you can actually execute effectively in the market. And there is obviously some amount of information you do actually need to share to be actually able to complete the trade. Otherwise, it's difficult to sign off on the deal. So what we did was give some guidance as to what constitutes appropriate sharing of information. We actually put that out. We put the first half of this out about in May last year, and that was one of the parts we put out. And I think, in my view at least, that aspect of market functioning has actually improved in the intervening 18 months or so since then. So as I said, this was very much about improving market functioning. The other thing which it was trying to do is there's a, as I said, there's a bunch of stuff which people can, which were fairly clearly bad and fairly, and a reasonable amount of stuff which was good. But actually, there were different views on particular aspects of what constitutes good practice. And in particular, there are different views on good practice between the sell side and the buy side of the market. And one of the things which I think we somewhat underestimated when we started this process was how useful it was to get people around the table, and I mean literally around the table, between all aspects of the market and get their different perspectives as to what constitutes good practice. And then actually having the sell side hear what the buy side thought and vice versa was actually useful, and we tried to distill that into what we've got here. And so if I take electronic trading, which is one of the more contentious issues in the market, so the way we got that written was actually here we had someone from who runs e-trading at one of the large global banks and someone who runs e-trading for one of the largest asset managers in the world. And the two of them actually were responsible for putting together the e-trading part of this document. And that was actually a really useful useful process in trying to reach some common understanding as to what constitutes good behaviour. So that's what the code is. How are we going to get people to follow it, adhere to it in the language that we used, given that it ain't regulation? So one of the things, there are a few different mechanisms we've got with the aim of achieving that. One is that we have given people a statement of commitment that someone very senior in the organisation, at least the head of FIC if you're at a bank and possibly even higher, signs it on behalf of their institution that they are indeed following the code and that they've put in place the appropriate monitoring, adherence and whatever to make sure that that all their staff, relevant staff, actually understand it. So this is fairly short, wasn't written by lawyers, I'm afraid, for all you lawyers in the room. It was actually, we actually tried to keep the lawyers out of this process as much as possible. No disrespect for the fact I'm standing here in Mallesons, but anyway, that was actually an aim. We had a bunch of lawyers from the central banking side just making sure that we didn't commit any audible faux pas in writing stuff which was clearly at odds with law. But one of the, to that point, though, we were dealing with 16 different legal jurisdictions here. So if we'd let the lawyers in, we would probably be finishing in around about 20 years' time rather than in the 2 years it actually took us. Or perhaps actually there was no solution given the different legal jurisdictions this is applying across. But anyway, so we have this short statement of commitment. There are now public registers up and about, and CLS, in fact, itself is providing such a register where market participants can actually post their statement of commitment so that you, as a market participant, can say, is this person I'm trading with, have they signed the statement of commitment? Can I hold them to account for that? One of the things we also require people they have to have a mechanism where their counterpart can actually raise a concern that they have in terms of how they see the counterpart trading in the market and some way of providing assurance that will be dealt with. And to that end, it often get asked what would be a measure of success. A measure of success is not that no bad behaviour ever happens again, because that's completely unrealistic. What would be a measure of success is actually a more of a self-reporting, self-detection aspect, which is, yep, something bad's happened, or one of our counterparties said, this doesn't look good to me, and actually something that came as a consequence of that. The other thing I think we're trying to do with that public register is that in the past, if you saw something, if you were getting treated badly by your counterparty, and then it wasn't a credible threat to say, I'm going to take my business somewhere else, because if you took your business somewhere else, you're probably going to get treated almost exactly the same way. So we're in a bad equilibrium where mistreating your customers was fairly endemic. That's most obviously clear around the fixing, where, amongst other things, the large participants in the market were sharing information with each other in what is now happily known as the cartel, which is a good name for a chat room, and that's actually what they called themselves. So that was clear that if you took your business somewhere else, all you're probably going to do is take it to another member of the cartel. That probably wasn't going to improve things. So what we are trying to do now is it's a credible threat to say, actually, I'm going to take my business somewhere else, and actually I've got a reasonable expectation that they will treat me treat me fairly. Most market participants have a range of counterparties, so it's not a big deal to switch your business from one person or to reallocate some of your business from one counterparty to another. Most people are set up and able to do that fairly easily in the wholesale market. So it is, if we can make it a credible threat to actually say, actually, I don't like the way you're treating with me, either fix it up or I'm taking my business elsewhere. And if I take it down the street, I actually have a reasonable confidence that that person will actually treat me fairly. So that, I think, is a good equilibrium. I also think that's actually good for business. So this is not antithetical to profit maximisation at all. So as I said, we've got these public registers up and running. At the moment in Australia, we've got where these statement of commitments are posted. We're running that on our Australian Foreign Exchange Committee website at the moment, and there may or may not be something else coming along in this part of the world for people to do that. There will also, we have now also got a global FXC body which is running, has got oversight over all of this, which spans those 15, 16 FX markets I was talking about earlier. It maintains the public-private aspect of it in the sense that each jurisdiction has one central bank and one private sector representative of it on it. And again, those private sector representatives, we've gone out of our way to make sure they're spread across the whole spectrum of the wholesale market. So this global FXC body will also provide a sort of register of registries where if you want to find out, okay, where do I find whether Citibank is signed the global code of, signed the statement of commitment, you can go to that site and find that. Use Citibank because they actually have already signed the statement of commitment globally in this market. Westpac did a month or two ago. And where our high expectation is that most of the market participants in major market participants in this market will have signed it hopefully by the end of the year or early early next year. We had received an undertaking from all of the people who are actually involved in this process in David Poo's group that they institutions will sign that. That probably covers around about 90% of turnover in the FX market, whichever way you want to cut it, sell side, buy side platforms, whatever. So a decently large chunk. I think so. We have that public register. We, as central banks, as market participants ourselves, have said that if you don't sign that statement of commitment, we're going to stop trading with you. Now, I'm under no misconception as to how important our business is. We don't do. We're in the market every day. We're not that big. So you lose our business, not that big a deal in terms of P&L. Might have a bit of a reputational consequence for you, my counterparts in China, they have a little bit more FX business and you lose their business, you're probably going to care about that. So it is, you know, if nothing else, it's a demonstration effect that our expectation is that people will sign the statement of commitment and adhere to it if you want to continue trading with us. So that, I think, is another aspect of discipline. The final part, and partly coming to where I think Justin was going, is the... Yeah, so while we're not regulators, there have a few regulators have taken a bit of interest in this. The FCA has made it as part of the senior managers regime in the UK. So in terms of the UK wholesale market, so that probably puts a bit of regulatory backing behind it. ASIC has endorsed it in their as part of their oversight of the FX market here locally. The Chinese actually went a little bit further and they actually wrote it into law. Interestingly, because they can do that sort of thing. So they did. So the only market where it is actually regulation, ironically, is China, where it is law. So as I said, that gives you a bit of a background. It was a public-private initiative. We had all sides of the market round the table, which I think is slightly different than a consumer code or can be different from a consumer code. So we had all of the perspectives reflected in putting this thing together. It is voluntary. It's not regulation, even though there's a few regulatory elements to it. But I think it's mostly about moving the market from a bad equilibrium in terms of market interaction to a good equilibrium in a way, which I think has the potential to be credible. So let me stop there.
Yeah. Guy made the point at the beginning that the lawyers were kept out deliberately. Stuart Fuller, let's bring you in. In terms of what do you think is the likely legal effect of the certification process?
Question without notice, Mr. Chairman. Well, actually, can I turn it around and ask the panel a question, if that's okay? Which is, I was very very interested when Guy went through what the different regimes have done, just on this point of starting out with that it wasn't regulation, it was an industry code, but then particularly, and putting China to one side, I think that's a unique jurisdiction, in the UK bringing it into the senior managers regime with all of the consequences that that brings for executives in banks, doesn't that effectively bring it right into the regulatory framework? And then from the lawyer's perspective, it then brings it into the realm of everything that institutions look for from both, whether it's compliance, adherence, or whatever, from the legal perspective. So I'm just wondering whether the way that it's been done in different jurisdictions, whether it starts out as a industry code but actually ends up in something that's more legalistic than not because of the regime that then looks to implement it.
At the very least, it establishes some sort of benchmark.
Could you just fix your mic, please? Sorry, we can't hear you in Melbourne.
All right, sorry.
Thank you.
Sorry, otherwise we'd have had dual mics up there. I still think because it's principles based, it gives you some idea about what the expectation is of the regulator as to what constitutes good practice, which happens to be in this case aligned with the industry's view of that. I mentioned that a number of the people we had working with us had been through the remediation process with the FCA, so they had a pretty decent idea, and they'd had to rewrite their own internal staff codes and procedures manuals, and so they had a pretty decent idea as to what was acceptable or not to the FCA, and that was distilled into this. It's got a regulatory element in it in the UK because of that, but it still is principles based, and so I suppose it provides a basis for the conversation you're going to have with the FCA. So the one thing we haven't done here, this is not, as I said, it's 55 principles. It's written in plain Australian. It is not a procedures manual. So, which effectively is another way of at least translating it into internal rules, if you want to think about it that way. But what we do say is that we would expect that your procedures manual should be consistent with this. The FCA can then go and have a look and say, in their view, is it consistent with this? I suppose it does certainly leave it open to, will different people potentially have different interpretations? Yeah, we can't guarantee that won't be the case. But by and large, I think it reflects a shared view as to what constitutes good practice. And I have a reasonable expectation that most people are going to share that view, the same view, including the relevant regulators.
Just, I went back to that, because I think it is the interaction between the regulatory regime and a code which can add legitimacy to the code. And the question of how you strike the balance of that becomes very important. Yeah. Maybe taking a slightly different example, AFMA in the past has provided guidance in relation to equity soundings and how that might be conducted. And this was developed by discussion with the law firms and the major investment banks and participants in the markets. And we spoke to ASIC about this, and they understood what we were doing. And so it's in fact, it's like a standard out there, which says this is how you might go about doing this. In practice, the way that works is when ASIC has gone and it's prepared a report subsequently on behaviours or conduct in the market, it looked to that to provide a guide as to what is considered by the industry to be acceptable practice. Now, people may vary from that, and people can readily argue, no, I don't do that, but I do something which I think is better, or in the context of my business, will be more efficient. But it is important to have that interaction, and by the way, we are talking wholesale markets here, because that balance, if you strike it right, gives you fantastic dynamic efficiencies. The people who prepare the code are the standard of the people working in the industry. They know where the issues are, and they know the balances that need to be struck. And when it comes to maintaining the code over time, well, they are participants who are sitting and looking and talking to each other through industry forums about how well that's working or not. So you have a ready mechanism through which you can update as required. But the dialogue with the regulator obviously is very important in that context. So I don't get concerned about the interaction. I think it's much more a question of ensuring that the interaction is set at the optimum level to achieve the most efficient outcomes for everyone involved, including the regulators.
Well, I think it's definitely the case if you think of Regulatory Guide 1803 in terms of fragmentation. Basically, there's no fragmentation in relation to this because it was the buy side and the sell side. Basically, it's designed to be global. In terms of recognition of the issues, basically, I think there's clear recognition within the wholesale market as to what those issues were. In terms of the process of certification, whether it be Citigroup or whether it be Westpac and other institutions moving forward, basically, I think there is clear recognition that this is useful. I take Guy's point that, you know, that you're not regulators, but I mean, there is an element of basically having the capacity to facilitate a dialogue. I think it is the case equally that there is really something really transformative, potentially really transformative about this FX code, which could send a positive signal back into domestic markets. Anna Bly from the ABA is here. What do you make of the FX code?
Okay. Look, I would agree, Justin, that whether it's this code or another in another part of the financial sector, there is something for all parts of the sector to learn. And particularly, if it does achieve the goal of transcending symbolism, if it can demonstrably have an effect on behaviour and on reputation, then others in the sector will be looking to the not only the components of the code that achieve that, but listening to Guy, I think, you know, some of the points he made was the process of getting there was as powerful as what ended up being written on the page. And I think one of the challenges with codes is, you know, in 15 years' time, probably none of the people who were part of getting there will still be in positions of seniority and influence in the sector. So how do you write into that, you know, that repeating of the process? I mean, I'll talk a little bit later about this, but I think in the banking industry, the code that we're now rewriting is a good example of one that was had a lot of powerful things happen when it was first put in place in 1993. And while it was tweaked in between, a comprehensive root and branch, let's all get back around the table and really examine the context that we're now working in and the very vastly changed world of, you know, payments and financial transactions since 1993. How do we make sure that we keep that on the agenda going forward?
I think one thing we've got some chance of pulling that off, which is, as I said, we've got this global FXC body. What we've said is each year we're going to make, partly reflecting the experience people have in the industry, we may make small tweaks to it. Every 3 years there's going to be a more wholesale review. That body, to your point about, you know, by the time we're all retired and everyone's forgotten about this, what happens then? So that body will keep on, the membership will keep on turning over. There will always be a decent chunk of people who are head of FIC at global, at the large global banks will be on that group. There will always be someone, and it will be a different person in 5 years' time than it is today, who will be running FX at a large asset manager. So there will be, we've got some chance of keeping that going by having at least established this timetable of regular review. I mean, the FX market is changing considerably, and so for no other reason than we can't write something which is going to be constant through time. I mean, some of the stuff is reasonably timeless, but some of it isn't. We have, as I said, we have a decently large chunk on electronic trading. You wouldn't have had that 10 years ago or 15 years ago, but it now constitutes a reasonably large chunk. I think, as I said, some part of it is timeless in the sense of no matter how you go about execution in the market, the actual mechanism can vary that a bit, but the general principle of what you're trying to achieve and what you're trying to do for your customer is reasonably time invariant. But as I said, we've given ourselves some sort of chance to maintaining that constancy in the market by the structure we've put in place to keep this thing current going forward.
And while it's not a requirement for regulatory agencies to take on board the code, they can't.
And I think that's the other point, is partly coming at Stuart's point. Different regulators can take this further to different degrees if they want. So if the FCA wants to go further on last look, say, may happen, then they can. I think what I don't want to say is we've established a minimum standard, because that isn't doesn't sound that good, and I think isn't what we've done. But at the very least, I would have a strong expectation that however the regulator wants to take it into more detail, it will be consistent with what we've got. So I did say that it'd be more about providing more detailed guidance if they felt so inclined. But whatever it is, the expectation would be it's going to be consistent with the principles we've got here.
I think the other thing which is very interesting about it in terms of how you define market participants, that it's basically across the buy and the sell side at institutional and at personal level, right? And so we've got Chris Whitehead from Finzia here representing one of the biggest financial services organizations representing individuals. What's your view on the FX code, Chris?
I'd come back to the point that was made that, you know, I think this has to sit alongside trading and accreditation. And so particularly from the perspective of the individual, I think it is the reinforcing effect of the participants, the market code of conduct. But ultimately that's supported. We've spoken about the importance of principles and values. Ultimately that's supported by the behaviour of individuals and what drives those individuals. So, you know, I think it is necessary to look at, you know, the institutional, the market participants' perspective, but also to look very much at that individual perspective and to ensure that the code is being backed up by good accreditation processes, good training processes to make it effective.
So just in relation to that, Anna's points I think her comments are right on point, because one of the outcomes of the Fair and Effective Market Review, one of its key findings was that there weren't codes, or where they were there, they weren't understood or weren't applied. So I think the whole design of the structure, both there through the FIC Market Standards Board, but also through the work of the Global Foreign Exchange Code, it's part of its DNA is to overcome those issues, because they've been very specifically recognised. And it does go as a, it's not a question of saying, well, here's the code of conduct and file it away somewhere. It's actually making it a living document through the kind of things Chris is speaking about. And that's why its relevance to the average person working in the industry is actually quite fundamental.
And that links back to the whole social license to operate, which underpins the Fair and Effective Markets Review and Mark Carney's conception of inclusive capitalism. But let's have a break now and keep on target. We'll break for coffee, an opportunity to network, and we'll reconvene at 10:20 to look at the retail side with Anna Black. Thanks very much indeed.